Welcome to the Habit Podcast, conversations with writers about writing. I'm Jonathan Rogers, your host. This summer on the Habit Podcast, I'm hosting a special series called Hometown Stories. The idea for this series began to take shape at the Habit Winter Writers Weekend this past February. A highlight of these weekends is Story Night, when writers from the Habit membership read their work out loud to the delight of all assembled. After that February Story Night, Carrie Givens pointed out that a disproportionate number of the stories involved the writers' hometowns, and she wondered out loud whether it might be fun to solicit more stories of other people's hometowns and present them as a podcast series. That sounded like a great idea to me, so I put the word out among the members of the Habit, and did they ever come through? I can't wait to share their great work with you over these next few episodes. And sprinkled in will be stories from writers whose voices you've heard before on the Habit Podcast. This is going to be a fun summer. In the most literal sense imaginable, this episode is brought to you by the Habit membership. Today, we'll visit hometowns in Georgia, British Columbia, New York State, and Kentucky. There will be nuclear superpowers, a fleeting high school crush that becomes in memory a deeper connection, a mysterious junk collector, and vampires. Up first is, well, me, with a story that I call Every Day in Middle Georgia is Air Force Appreciation Day. This story is called Every Day in Middle Georgia is Air Force Appreciation Day. I grew up in Warner Robins, Georgia. It's an Air Force town just below Macon, right in the middle of the state. When I say it's an Air Force town, I don't mean it's a town where the Air Force decided to build a base. I mean, at the beginning of World War II, the Air Force found a blank spot on the map, a swampy, sandy, empty place beside the railroad tracks, and put a big base there. Then a town grew up beside it. The town is actually named for the base, which was named for Brigadier General Augustin Warner Robins, father of logistics for the modern Air Force. That's what I mean when I say Warner Robins is an Air Force town. In the 1980s, a rumor spread that we were number 3 on the Soviet Union's list of places to blow up in the event of nuclear war. Number 3. I was never clear on who number 1 and number 2 were. I guess it was Washington, D.C., then New York City, then Warner Robins. All the kids in Warner Robins seemed to believe this rumor. I know I did. As well as a surprising number of the adults. You might think that being in the crosshairs of a nuclear superpower would create a pervading sense of existential dread. Not at all. It was quite exhilarating, actually. Folks in Macon might make fun of us. Folks in Atlanta might not even know we exist. But the Soviet Union, they understood that the people of Warner Robins were not to be trifled with. You take your sense of self-importance where you can get it. Speaking of self-importance, Warner Robins' nickname, self-assigned, is Georgia's International City. I guess this was because some of the airmen on the base had been stationed in Germany and Guam and other Air Force bases around the world. I know what you're thinking. Wouldn't Atlanta be Georgia's international city? Nope, it's Warner Robins. My grandmother had a license plate on the front of her Oldsmobile that read, "We live in Warner Robins, Georgia's international city." In the top left corner was a smiling sunshine. She had this license plate before I could read, I guess before I was born, and I remembered it as being one of the first things I ever read that wasn't on paper. It really made an impression on me that words could just ride around like that, that they didn't have to be in a book. For some reason, it was a long time, maybe a couple of years, before I noticed that the smiling sunshine in the corner also contained words. "We're lucky!" exclamation point. "We're lucky! We live in Warner Robins, Georgia's international city." I didn't know how to feel about my grandmother driving around with such a license plate on her car. I felt lucky to live in Georgia's international city. Of course I did. But it seemed a little braggy. I imagined my grandmother piloting that Oldsmobile through the streets of a nearby town, Perry, Hawkinsville, Fort Valley, stirring up the envy of the locals. "We're lucky. We live in Warner Robins, Georgia's international city." Because the unspoken message was, you don't live in Warner Robins. It seemed unnecessary, even unkind. Warner Robins has a city motto. It may be the longest motto any city has ever had. Every day in Middle Georgia is Air Force Appreciation Day. That 9-word motto is usually abbreviated down to the 9-letter initialism EDIMGIAFAD. I've even heard people pronounce it as a word, Edimgiafad. You'd often see that acronym on business signs with the changeable letters or on local publications or on the water tower. We didn't have botanical gardens or much in the way of carefully tended parks. What we did have, at the foot of the water tower, were boxwood shrubs pruned into the shape of those nine letters, E-D-I-M-G-I-A-F-A-D. I'd love to know whose idea that was, because it's a lot of work and expense to plant boxwoods that say E-D-I-M-G-I-A-F-A-D and to maintain them for 40 or 50 years that I know of, maybe more. I realize there's something ludicrous about all this boosterism. It is possible that Warner Robins doth protest too much, but I have to say it worked on me. I've always loved Warner Robins. I used to think I loved it because it was pretty much the best town in the world, but now I have sense enough to know that I love it because it's the place where I was born and raised, where I had a happy childhood, and that's reason aplenty. When I last saw the E-D-I-M-G-I-A-F-A-D shrubbery, I thought of something G.K. Chesterton said. Men did not love Rome because she was great. She was great because men had loved her. I can say the same for Warner Robins, Georgia's international city, and I think the Russians would agree. I have scarcely touched on what I consider to be the most interesting thing about Warner Robins, or in any case, Warner Robins in the years when I was growing up there. As I mentioned already, Robins Air Force Base was built in World War II. It immediately grew into quite a large base. It employed 20,000 people, maybe more than that, during the war. But the great majority of those employees were civilian rather than military. So here's what I want you to picture. A new employer opens up in quite a poor part of Georgia, right where the rolling red clay hills play out and things start to get flat and sandy. Thousands and thousands of good-paying jobs. And all those farmers who had been working so hard and failing so often to scratch a living out of that sand said, "You know, I think I could learn to drive a forklift or do sheet metal. And I believe I could even learn to sit at a desk if somebody gave me a check every 2 weeks." And so this decent-sized town, 35, 40,000 people, sprung up like a mushroom across the railroad tracks from the base, populated mostly by people who had never lived in a decent-sized town, or maybe any town, before. And a whole lot of them were brand new to the middle class and economic security. It was this huge social experiment around the phenomenon of country come to town. What happens if you take tens of thousands of poor but independent farm people and make a town out of them, introduce them to government bureaucracy and desk jobs, and give them the first regular paychecks they've ever seen? Well, one thing happens that I would have never predicted. They plant bushes that spell out E-D-I-M-G-I-A-F-A-D. So that's where I was born in 1969, and where I grew up in the 70s and 80s. Almost nobody of my parents' generation was born in Warner Robins, because there was no Warner Robins when they were born. The Rogers family arrival in Warner Robins was pretty typical. My father's father, Ewell Rogers, was a not very successful farmer working rented land in Dodge County, Georgia. When World War II broke out, he was too old for the military, but he heard about the Air Force base that had opened 40 miles away, and some of his neighbors had made the move, so the Rogers family pulled up stakes and moved to the Ziegler Apartments in Warner Robins and got running water and electricity for the first time in their lives. My father, DeLacy, was 7 or 8 at the time. After his first day of school, he walked home to Ziegler Apartments. Only then did he realize that one Ziegler apartment looked exactly like any other Ziegler apartment, and he didn't know about apartment numbers. So he wandered up one row of those little low-slung buildings and down the next row, up and down, until he had seen them all, and then he started over again, up and down and up and down. But he still had no idea which of these identical apartments belonged to the Rogers family, and he started to cry. And the way he told it, he had about decided to lay down and die right there in the gravel drive when he noticed a diaper hung to dry on the diagonal bar across the bottom half of the screen of a screen door. Exactly the way his mother hung his baby sister's diaper to dry on the screen door of their farmhouse in Dodge County. That diaper, it turned out, was a welcome home banner for that little stranger in a strange land. And he decided not to lay down and die after all, but to live there in Georgia's international city. When the war ended, my grandfather Ewell was eager to quit the city and go back to the country. He said he thought they'd be closing the base now that the war was over, but mostly I think he just wanted to get back to what he knew. My grandmother Hazel, on the other hand, she liked having electricity and running water. She liked her appliances. When Ewell carried her back to Dodge County, she brought her refrigerator and her washing machine and had them deposited on the front porch of their rental house, which still had neither electricity nor running water. And there the refrigerator and the washing machine sat, a silent protest and a rebuke, until Ewell finally gave in a few years later and moved her and her appliances back to Warner Robins. They lived out their days there and thereabouts, and so did my father and all his sisters, and so did my mother's family, who also immigrated from South Georgia shortly after Ewell and Hazel. So there we were, all of us Robinites, the adults all displaced from somewhere else, we kids all from a different place from the place our parents were from. I believed what my grandmother's license plate said. I was lucky. I lived in Warner Robins, Georgia's international city. And yet I was captivated by all those stories my father told about growing up poor in Dodge County. Those stories felt a little truer than the stories we were telling ourselves in Warner Robins about our international status and the Russians' desire to blow us up as soon as they had finished off D.C. and New York City. I was jealous of my father's stories. More to the point, it felt to me like there was an unbridgeable gulf between his story and mine. I was growing up soft and cityfied. He had grown up hard and country, carrying well water and driving his sisters to school when he was only 12 years old and picking cotton. Truth is, I don't imagine he actually picked that much cotton. But still, in my mind, he was a picker of cotton, whereas I was a watcher of television and a writer of occasional poetry. Dodge County was like Shangri-La to me. I knew all the lore and legends. I knew about Mrs. Jolly, my father's beloved teacher at Chester School, commandeering an empty peanut truck to take her class on a field trip after they had been bus left. I knew about the old boy who made a roaring machine out of a nail keg and a rosin string and roared it around Gum Swamp for the mere pleasure of making his neighbors believe that a swamp monster was on the prowl. But like Shangri-La, Dodge County was a place we never went, even though it was less than 40 miles away. When I was 12 or 13, I asked my father to take me to Dodge County to show me some of the scenes he had told me about. He seemed pleased I had asked. We drove down Chicken Road, the name of which seemed too good to be true. I had wondered before if my father had made it up, but there it was, as big as life and twice as natural. He showed me the part of Gum Swamp where he had learned to swim. He took me to Macedonia Baptist Church, and there in the graveyard I saw chiseled in stone many of the names that wove through my father's family stories. Holland, Mullis, Brown, lots of Rogerses. I saw the graves of both my father's Aunt Willie's, Aunt Willie Pearl and Aunt Willie Ruth. We went fishing with my father's Uncle Wade. Wade was still in Dodge County because when everybody else was moving to Warner Robins during World War II, he was off fighting in the European theater. On D-Day, he survived the landing at Omaha Beach. When he finally got back to Dodge County, he stayed there. When we had lunch, Uncle Wade, this man I had scarcely ever seen, said a blessing I had heard every day of my life, but had never heard spoken by anybody besides my father. Dear Lord, humble our hearts and make us truly grateful for these and all thy many blessings. Amen. Either my father got that prayer from Uncle Wade, or they both got it from the same place. Hearing it at Wade's table, I felt something like I imagine my father felt when he saw that diaper on the screen door in Ziegler Apartments. Here are my people, even in this strange and distant land. We made one last stop before we headed home. It was the fall, and the cotton bolls were white in the field and ready for picking. My father pulled the truck off the road at one of the cotton fields and said, "Come on, let's pick some cotton." It was going to be the perfect end of the day. Father and son, side by side in a cotton field. I was going to get a good taste of what it meant to be a Dodge County boy. I wasn't, of course, a Dodge County boy, so I didn't understand that the dry brown leaves around a cotton bowl weren't so much leaves as a nasty sharp burr. When I reached for the first bowl, a piece of that burr jabbed right up under my fingernail and into the soft nail bed. I was amazed at how bad it hurt. And I was amazed at how quickly that physical pain turned to deep, deep shame. When my father was my age, he picked cotton all day. But I couldn't pick one bowl of cotton without wanting to cry. Again, I'm pretty sure my father wasn't picking cotton all day when he was 12 or 13 or ever. But that's the way I had it in my mind, and the gulf yawned again, as wide as ever, between the soft-handed city boy and his father. Shaming me was the farthest thing from my father's mind. He thought we were connecting. And I wish I'd given him the chance to tell me so. Instead, I hid my face from him so he wouldn't see how weak I was. I said a little while ago that in Warner Robins, nobody was from the same place as their parents. The truth is, nobody is from the same place as their parents, or ever can be. So we misunderstand our parents, and we parents misunderstand our kids, and we hurt one another when all we really want to do is connect. If I didn't learn that from being a son, you can believe I have learned it since I've become a father. At the end of Norman MacLean's A River Runs Through It, that father preacher who never understood his son Paul and was never understood by him says, It is those we live with and love and should know who elude us. True enough. But I find great hope in something the old preacher's other son, the narrator, tells him. You can love completely without complete understanding. My father died a couple of years ago. Did we ever understand one another completely? I don't reckon so. But you can love completely without complete understanding. One of these days, my father and I are going to see one another again in the new heavens and the new earth, in the new Jerusalem, and I hope in the new Warner Robins. And there every day will not be Air Force Appreciation Day, because as the old spiritual has it, we ain't going to study war no more. The lion will lie down with the lamb, and the Russians will lie down with the good people of Warner Robins. We will know in full because we will be fully known, and I will tell my father that he was a good father. And my father, I hope, will tell me that I was never too soft or too citified for his tastes, and I'll be able to hear it. Lord, haste the day. Anna Eastland is a poet in Vancouver, British Columbia. Her hometown story, Kootenai Glacier Crush, is actually a poem. In it, the sorrows and griefs of adulthood give new significance to an old memory.
Kootenai Glacier Crush by Anna Eastland. Slipping into a hot bath to escape my nasty cold, I slip back in time to that starlit night in the hot springs just after high school, when I came home from the city to visit our village of New Denver. You and I there in the woods with a few friends, soaking in the heat as the cool dark caressed our faces, upturned to see nothing but cedars and starlight. My foot gently touched yours just barely, a quiet question unanswered. I drew in the crisp night air and held my breath, wonder drunk with the nearness of you. And you, a gentleman in disguise, the former class ruffian, remember how you used to tease me at school? Now taking me out as a friend for old time's sake. And I, aflutter with your kindness, seeking deep in the warm embrace of water and wondering, what if? After the hot springs, we went to the local pub up the hill in Silverton. You bought me my first glass of wine and brought me home to my parents' doorstep, hugged me goodbye, and that is all. But all I could think about for months was you. I finally got up the courage to send you a card, way back then when mail was more of a thing. I remember it had a drawing of an old-fashioned car on it. I don't remember, but likely some hesitant confession of love inside. It went unanswered. Years later, time having fled and you and I both married with children, I heard the crushing news of the death of your son. Only 10 years old, with big brown eyes like his father, drowned in the water at Christmas, when your car crashed over the hairpin curve of the highway and into Slocan Lake. My chest tightened hearing of your near hypothermia as you went back down again and again into those glacier-fed waters to rescue him, but could not. Wild sorrow reawoke in my belly, for I know the pain of losing a child. My own little daughter died in my warm womb on her way out. She met the world in silence. Both taken in the water, by waters no longer safe, unlike the hot springs on that summer night long ago, with the night's coolness kissing our skin. Now the slow weight of time has carved out our hearts like a glacier, sorrow's unstoppable scarring imprinted on the landscape of our lives. I want to touch you again, to find that boy from high school and wipe away his manly tears, or let them mingle with mine. My desire is a silent prayer, my heart reaching out to you over the many miles between us. For now, I meet you only in memory.
Our next hometown story comes from Jana Shirk. I love the economy with which she captures the beauty of the Finger Lakes region of New York State. And I love the tenderness with which she speaks of a man who scraped together a life on the margins of her hometown.
Foraging scraps. The sound of his lawn tractor puttering up the farm drive most often was swallowed in the hum of machinery, diesel engines, air compressors, and the song of the milk house. He always parked just up in the hump of grass right in front of the main barn, his small rusty trailer behind heaped to a scrap. He was always foraging for odds and ends metal, and our farmyard, like most, seemed to perennially bloom with it. Empty tin cans, rusted nails, stray screws, pieces of aluminum siding, rusted equipment that could no longer be coaxed into one more go. It's the law of entropy. It's the way of all things mechanical. Once shiny new, it will eventually sink its way to the junkyard. He dressed in faded overalls, patched and worn. The stripes of his denim cap were sun-bleached to the point of near invisibility. Lines, long and drawn, coursed his face, penciled in shades of sadness, and even as a young girl, I sensed it. He never stayed at the farm long. His tractor would sit idle in the dusty drive an hour or two, maybe. He spoke Finn-like, stoic, and infrequently. There are a lot of rests in the music of that speech, a steady cadence of silence that intersperses the sparse phrases. Those farm drive visits between my papa and he, my uncle, my dad, were marked with this quiet knowing. Did he find an anchor in that silent communion? From the first verdant greening fuzzy-tipped branches of April through the naked limbs of November, spread prayer-like over the fallow fields, he drove his lawn tractor steadily, day in, day out, over the hills. When winter winds cut through upstate New York and snow drifted feet high across the fields, roads were impassable for such a small vehicle. Ours was a small town, settled predominantly by European immigrants, Finnish prominent among them. Our postcard bid for fame lay in the old covered bridge, still in use today. Beyond that, it was primarily an agricultural community, acres and acres of farmland hemmed in by miles and miles of forest. Nestled at the base of the Finger Lakes, tree-lined hills drape over the landscape like a rumpled patchwork quilt. In its season of peak beauty and longing, all of the maples, oaks, ashes, elms, and birches stand ablaze in waterfalls of color. Of true waterfalls, there is no lack either. Within a short drive from my childhood home, Treeman, Buttermilk, Taganic, and Watkins Glen tumble. There are gorges and hollows, dirt roads, precipitous drop-offs, spring mayflowers, trillium, summer grasses, and Indian pipes. The land is rich in forests and fields, rivers and rivulets, loose shale and rocks that pry their way surface-bound every spring. Rocks were our first annual harvest. I'm told that my own Finnish ancestors found a land not unlike their home here after they had worked their fingers to calluses in the mines of Minnesota. I always knew he was Finn, this solitary pilgrim on his lawn tractor, but I didn't know for many years that my great-grandmother was his mother's sister and that we shared blood, too. I couldn't fathom then, and I can't now, how many miles he must have traversed alone, driving that ponderously slow vehicle open to the elements, the hours he spent hunched over the wheel, driving, ever driving. He had little else left to him by that point, little but time. He was drafted during World War II, just like his brother, just like my dad's father, just the same as thousands of young men on the verge of adulthood across our nation. His brother came home at the end of the war, celebrated and bedecked with honor. He did not. He had grown up rooted in that same farm soil, but he couldn't transition to being a soldier, not even to the training. It wasn't in him. After he was discharged dishonorably, he was admitted to psychiatric care. I think he would have been a kind, steadfast, hardworking farmer had history written him a different story, had the world not inverted on him and cast him out. Instead, he came home broken down, scrapped out, shunned by his brother for the rest of his life. So he orbited our small farming community, never quite belonging, never quite grounded, like a satellite flung away to revolve, if but closely, his once home. He faithfully cared for his mother until her death in the large farmhouse that had seen his happiest days. After their mother died, his brother showed him little charity. I wonder now if the scraps he gathered were all he could muster to pull the remnants of his life into some semblance of meaning. He had lost his way somewhere in that requisitioned soldier training, and he never seemed to find it. After he was gone, after his brother was gone and the property was divided to sell, we purchased the pasture and barn that adjoined our property. When we cleaned the barn, there were still metal relics and fragments stored away where he had tucked them, like a haunting insurance policy against a day of need. I think about him in spring, remembering that first annual trip of the small tractor hauling its wagon against odds and gravity up the hill, his face weathered, ruddy, lined, and sandpapered. His gloved hands gripped the steering wheel, making meaning of what was left over. It makes me sad, and it fills me with longing, that longing for true home. I wonder what thoughts filled his mind all of those hours driving slowly through the beauty of the changing seasons, past the fields rolling with clover, timothy, rye, alfalfa, oats, and wheat. He hugged the shoulder of the road, dusty clouds spinning slightly in his wake. Cars sped by him, racing from pillar to post, but he kept his eyes forward, unruffled. I like to think he was farming, the way my dad's eyes farmed every field we passed on the way to anywhere, approximating moisture content, scanning for pests, calculating acreage and yield. I like to think that every shard of scrap metal was a piece of promise he could hold tangibly, that every load rattling behind him on his wagon served a purpose. I like to think there was still good left for him to find on every plodding voyage he made. I like to think he would be glad to be remembered. So when I do, I remember him with honor.
At this year's Habit Winter Writers Weekend, the one I told you about at the beginning of this episode, Elizabeth Harwell brought down the house with a story you're about to hear. Elizabeth lives near Atlanta, where she enjoys the wide variety of cheeses. But she grew up in Murray, Kentucky. Murray didn't have nearly so many cheese options, but it had Atlanta beat all to Flinders with regard to... You know what? I'm just going to let Elizabeth tell you. Here's Elizabeth Harwell reading her story, This Immortal Town.
Riding a tractor to the last day of class at Callaway County High School is an end-of-the-year tradition in Murray, Kentucky. While it's true that not everyone owns a tractor in Callaway County, it is also true that everyone knows someone who owns a tractor, which is to say that no one has an excuse. My friends lived on cow farms, tobacco farms, soybean, corn, and watermelon farms. We played flashlight tag, dodging cow patties and electric fences. One of my prouder moments is when my best friend's dad called to tell me about his new calf. "I named her Libby," he said, "after you." The boys of Callaway came to school in jeans and muddy boots from their early morning chores and left right at the last bell for their shift on the combine. Brittany Bean often had a new belt buckle to show us on Monday mornings from her barrel racing win that weekend at the rodeo. It would seem to most that this small farming community would be little acquainted with what I assumed to be the dealings of city life. Public transportation, for instance. Starbucks coffee. Dinner reservations. Vampires. And one would be right on all accounts, except for the vampires. Rod Farrell was a student at Callaway County High School who claimed to be a 500-year-old vampire. In 1996, he drove to Florida and murdered the parents of his then-girlfriend. At 17, he became the youngest person in Florida on death row. At 18, his sentence was reduced to life imprisonment, which probably seems like an eternity to a vampire. This all happened 2 years before I entered the high school at Callaway. And while the looming threat of Rod had dissolved, his cult had not. You may wonder what it's like to go to school with vampires, and I'm here to bear witness to my own particular experience with the agrarian variety. In the lunchroom, we had our self-assigned tables. The senior table was in the middle of the room like a shrine around which we all revolved. The popular kids, or the preps as we called them, had their own respective table for each grade. Then there were the kids who liked to talk about gaming, a table for the football players. a group of us who were in youth group together and who used lunchtime for both Bible study and gossip. And as it was, the vampires had their own lunch table too. The vampire clan dressed mostly in black and preferred long trench coats for their outerwear, which were later outlawed by our dress code for being too vampire-y. The girls wore thicker makeup and heavier eyeliner, and the boys liked to keep their hair long and greasy. Sometimes they wore small vials of blood around their neck. They ate chicken nuggets on Wednesdays like the rest of us. They had lockers and changed into gym clothes. They used the water fountain between classes and had a similar disliking for Mr. King's U.S. history class. It's easy to see how, after the initial shock, these ghouls of the night faded into the background of our life at Callaway County High. I might try to avoid a vampire in the hallway between classes, but I also avoided making eye contact with a certain bleach blonde sophomore. He might tell all of Algebra 2 that I had a crush on him and then make gagging noises to get a laugh from the crowd. There were greater concerns for a 16-year-old girl than bloodsuckers and coffins and all of that. After graduation, my best friend Becca and I stayed in Murray to attend the local university, and we started rubbing shoulders with city folk who moved on to campus. Our new best friend Jenny was from Nashville. We liked her, of course, but she did bring out some of our insecurities, like our lack of coffee shops and our selections of cheese. Becca would mock the way she talked about life in the city. "Oh, I wish we could just take a bypass. If she loves bypasses so much, why doesn't she marry one?" Becca would say and roll her eyes. Once at dinner with Jenny, Becca and I started laughing about the time she woke up to find the severed heads of goats on her neighbor's fence post. Jenny's eyes got as wide as her plate, and we knew immediately she wouldn't last a minute in a deer stand. "It was just the vampires," we laughed. Her expression didn't change. "You know," we said, "just dumb vampire activity." Maybe the vampires in her town didn't perform animal sacrifices. It's a wonder Jenny wanted to keep hanging around us after that, but I guess after learning she had moved into a town with vampire activity, she needed to keep us close. She couldn't afford to cut us off now. "Where do the vampires live?" Jenny would ask. "Is it safe to be out at night?" And it was only when she started asking the questions that I had them too, like, what did other people drive to school on their last day of class? And what did Friday nights look like, if not driving the loop around town in a pickup truck? Once the world of high schools without vampires opened up to me, I started to wonder what else we were missing out on, and would we ever get out of this town to see it? Becca, as it turns out, moved to Manhattan, where she not only enjoyed the bypasses, but could also navigate the subway system like the halls of her own home. I'm living in a suburb of Atlanta, and am truly enjoying both the coffee shops and the wide variety of cheese. But the truth is that there's only one place in this world where Donnie Boyd is throwing hay to my namesake, and where you can hang on the fence to watch Brittany Bean and her horse, Obie, lean almost to falling as they race around barrels. I'd be willing to argue with you that the most breathtaking stage for a crowd of lightning bugs is over a soybean field off of Rather Road. And if you're lucky enough to be in Murray on a Thursday night for a university football game, you'll come out of your seat when the announcer booms over the speakers to clear the track after a touchdown. Like a burst, the sleek thoroughbred Racer One will break onto the brick-red running track and make her victory lap around the field. I held my breath for her entire loop as a child. I don't know how I didn't see the peculiarity then, the wild and shocking world I moved about in every day. I guess it's near impossible to see the water we are swimming in. I wonder what would happen if we could get out on the other side and be an observer of our own life, our whole face pressed against the glass, taking it all in at once. Could we then re-enter as astonished ones? Would we be any better for it? I'm not so sure. We love a place not because we are bowled over by it, but because we walk in it as ones at home. Astonishment is a gift, but it's not where life happens. Life happens in cow pastures, in hallways, in lunchrooms, where everything feels just as dime a dozen as a table of teenage vampires.
This podcast is brought to you by The Rabbit Room, where art nourishes community and community nourishes art. And all our podcasts are made possible by the generous support of our members. To learn more about us, visit rabbitroom.com. And to become a member, rabbitroom.com/donate.